we talk with Lieutenant Colonel retired Nikki Dean about her important work at the World War I Museum in Kansas City, operational art, and the significance of narrative.
If you were to look at the United States just from its monuments that exist in Washington, D.C. alone, you'd stand back and think that we were a nation built for war.
Hello, welcome to the Operational Arch, bridging the gap between tactics and strategy, and the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. My name is Major Sheila Holder, alongside Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Corliss, and we will be your hosts for this episode. With us today is Lieutenant Colonel retired Nikki Dean. Lieutenant Colonel Dean spent over 20 years in the Army. She is an aviator and an AMSP graduate who finished her military career at the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate, where she was instrumental in the development of the latest FM 3-0 multi-domain operations. Ms. Dean is currently a military history interpreter at the World War I Museum, located in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. In addition, she is nearing completion of her PhD in collections management, military history, and provenance research and curation, which makes her more than an expert to talk to us about military history and understanding modern operations. Lieutenant Colonel Dean, welcome back to Fort Leavenworth SAMS and AMSP.
It's great to be back here at Flint Hall. It's bringing back a lot of memories. Some of them are good, some of them are a memory back to what it was like to find dry erase markers. Super fun.
You know, the stress levels haven't changed. So, a little bit of an administrivia before we go on. So I'm married to a helicopter pilot. I know you are an Army helicopter pilot, and I promised her I would not make any helicopter jokes today. As long as you promise not to make any stuck wing jokes, I think we can just agree to get along and talk about museums instead.
Maybe, I suppose.
All right,
maybe.
Well, the truce holds for now. Obviously, museums is not something, you know, that a lot of us are familiar with. You know, some of us might go and see and enjoy. But for those listening and those of us here in the room, can you just kind of give us an idea of what you do at the World War I Museum?
First of all, I came to the World War I Museum, like a lot of people that come here for either the CGSC or for SAMS, right? You go down as somebody that's just taking a tour or actually interacting with the collection itself as a guest. It has been a museum that has always stuck with me as a student. So when I had an opportunity with the University of Kansas, where I'm pursuing my graduate degree and then also doing postgraduate work as well, to go work as an intern with the National World War I Museum and Memorial, I took it. I took it as an opportunity. And then directly after that internship, they asked very sweetly and very politely, would I like to stay on and work as a historian, interpreter, and researcher for them? Which for me was it was a bit of a shock, partly because I thought my world was always going to wander into provenance curation and research, helping out with restitution and the application of art law. It turns out, I actually really love military history too, so I'm sticking around with them for as long as they'll have me.
Like you said, many of us as students attend offsites at the World War I Museum, which I've found to be very valuable to my SAMS experience. You've also hosted several seminars there, which I think help us understand operational art from various lenses. I particularly enjoyed your Women in Warfare talk discussing the role of women in military theory. So how do you think us as professional military officers can leverage museums like the World War I Museum to enhance our understanding of operational art?
So museums, there's this real tension that exists in the museum world, right? This idea of, is the museum for the collection or is the museum, does it exist for people and for education purposes? And for me, I see it as doing both, right? The purpose of the collection is to be activated in such a way, and that includes the building itself and the people who work there, to engage audiences and to engage. Part of that is also extending itself to be an engagement platform for different types of audiences, like military individuals who are looking for professional development. The wonderful thing about a World War Museum is that covers a really broad swath. You know, when you're talking about a war museum is, if we think back to Young Men in Fire and the idea of, you know, the theory of a phenomenon and the theory of action, right? Those two things. A war museum explores this phenomenon of war as it applies to a large swath of population, a huge experience, right? So we can get after things like social changes, broad sweeping social changes, like the idea of women emerging into social culture. But also at the same time, we can talk about things that are very, very specific to military history, things like modernization, a theory of action, if you will, the idea of the development of new tactics or techniques, the idea of advancement in combined arms maneuver, which was something that suddenly, especially with military doctrine about 1917 in the 1918 timeframe, we began to embrace as a military or as an army ourselves. So those are really important things that we can use as museums to reach military audiences. Part of that is also military audiences seeking out opportunities and recognizing that museums are platforms for us to do professional development. And it's not just war museums or military service museums. It's all museums have a way of speaking through their collections and activating their collections as a way to teach and help us understand our humanity, because war is a fundamentally human endeavor, according to U.S. doctrine, if you get that and jive with it.
I've read a little bit.
Oh. Yeah. You would be one of the few. Sometimes I wonder. It's like...
So, but that's a good point, though, is, you know, whether we're going to the World War I Museum here in Kansas City or the National World War II Museum down in New Orleans or even any of the museum, when we went to World War I, you asked us, what were your favorite museum ever went to? And I would say 90% of us offered a military museum. And that probably just speaks to our profession. But regardless, if you come from the Air Force, the Army, Space Force, you know, how can you prepare yourself to understand the narrative and the operational art that's being presented to you when you walk in the front door?
Well, so the exact way that you all came to the museum itself, and I'm thinking most recently, you know, the seminars that came as part of GPP, of the Great Power Project, and those perspectives, coming in and looking at it from the very narrow lens of the Ottoman Empire, but also wanting to understand more about the nation of Turkey and the Turkish people. When you did that, right, everybody showed up, first of all, having done quite a bit of homework on it, right? You come armed with a lot of information and a lot of pre-reading done. I would say the first thing that anybody does is establish some assumptions and some facts. Yeah, like you would with a military person. First assumption I would make is museums, particularly national museums like the National World War I Museum, they have a bias for the country where they're located. You think of Invalides in Paris, or the Canadian Imperial War Museum in Ottawa, or even our own museum here in Kansas City, right? We're always going to orient on that sort of national perspective because we're talking to an audience that is interested in America's or your own nation's view of warfare. So knowing that going in is important. It'll help you frame how you want to approach the material and how you want to engage with it, or how you want your soldiers to engage with it, or your airmen, sailors, and so forth. The other thing is that I would look at placing any facts, any information, because museums try to maintain neutrality as best as possible, recognizing that museums are authoritative institutions of education and enjoy that unique perspective and unique position in society. But placing the facts and the information that they're providing in historical period with the artistic movement sometimes that they're seeing, the major events as they're interpreted by that nation, right? And then finally, the other assumption I'd make is that there are exceptions to this rule. So you mentioned everybody comes up and, you know, most of us, when we go around the room and say, you know, what's most memorable museum experience or favorite museum. I was in the group too, right? Verdun is probably one of my most powerful museums that I've ever seen. And it's not necessarily because of the fact that it was France versus Germany, or that discussion of orienting on French historical perspectives, though that's where the museum is. It was the fact that it was taken from this perspective of soldiers versus the meat grinder of Verdun. Location matters, but the historical, what that museum is attempting to accomplish, fundamentally changed my view of what museums could do with their collections to bridge really important gaps in national understanding and national perspective. And then the other thing I do is, like, if you're going to go to a museum, have some basic facts, like the size and scope. You can do reconnaissance straight off the bat, right, from a website. Look at the mission statement. Look at the vision of the museum. That'll give you an indication of what they're attempting to accomplish, which just about every museum has a mission and vision, which for a lot of people, I think, outside of the military, you don't realize, you don't think about. And also, go ahead if you're a museum, if you're interested in what the museum is providing, check and see what their public programming and their educational outreach offers, because you'd be surprised at just how many museums, partly because of K-12 programming, grade school level programming, and field trips, which is most people's first experience to a museum, they will have, you're already going to have a foundation of material and interest in grounding that collection and teaching people. So, hey, like I said, facts, assumptions, do a site recon. It's amazing how much doctrine sticks with you after you leave. You're like, no, I wish it wouldn't.
It's a forever thing. Huh?
So kind of a quick follow-up to that then. So for the, you know, the hobby historians or the keyboard historians that show up to your museum and do like the whataboutism, like, well, what about this story? Or what, you know, you skimmed over this incredible, you know, very nuanced detail. It's important, it's history, but it doesn't fit that narrative that you're talking about. How do you kind of frame, if you want to use the terms of Sam's, what to tell and what to maybe not emphasize?
So my audience always drives the stories that I tell. And I was actually thinking about that on the way up here. I was listening on just recently to an incredible conversation or a talk that was being given down at the University of Kansas Law Center, in which they were talking about the intersection of museums and law. And the idea of making sure you know your audience, of understanding what your audience needs to know or what would engage them best. So for instance, when individuals of Sam's and from the schoolhouse come down to Kansas City and down to the bunker, the first thing that I'm thinking about is you've got to be able to use this material after you leave. Like I love the idea of sometimes knowledge for knowledge's sake, but if it's not something that y'all can use or can make you feel connected to the experience of war throughout history, then it's time for me to reexamine what I'm teaching. Though on occasion, sometimes it's the random little things that people seem to gravitate to. You know, stories of like, oh, it's French 75. Also, it's not just a piece of artillery and cannon. It's also a cocktail. Oh, who knew?
So you already brought this up a little bit, but you know, with every discussion of narrative or storytelling, there's a worry about bias in the narrative. So you speak to, obviously, this is a national museum, has a national narrative that we're hoping to, you know, project. What are some ways, from your perspective, to identify or at least understand where those biases may be and what they mean to our experience?
So the idea of looking at a museum, and this is difficult, right? Because I have friends that are down with me at class at the University of Kansas that would be like, we work in science museums and there is only one right answer to science and that is science. And it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. But when you're looking at it from the perspective of art or history museums or even historical sites and monuments, part of it is first of all, recognizing that the land or the terrain that you're standing on and how that may have influenced why that facility exists or why that institution exists. And then secondly, is part of it comes from seeking the other side of a story. So if you see objects behind a glass vitrine, you're not just saying, all right, well, I understand that there are the victor writing history, but also at the back end, all wars are connected. So therefore, our belligerents, every belligerent should be examined to see, how did they contribute to that narrative? What happened afterwards? All of that is important, right? And it's the same way with any sort of, when you're framing an operational environment, you don't just look at one province, one organization, one military. You're looking at how it sits within the operational environment altogether in order to understand the human dimension, the information dimension, the physical dimension. All of that applies, right? And just because it's a museum and not MDMP, it's that those same thing, yeah. Expansive, good understanding is important.
So kind of changing gears a little bit. So now that you're on the outside looking in, right? You were in the Army, you retired, and now you could kind of look back with rose-colored goggles. How does being involved in curation in the museum, and especially something as significant as World War I, how does that change your opinion about, you know, FM3O and doctrine and operational art and all that stuff that you were involved with while you were in the Army?
You know, the funny thing was when you, because you guys had mentioned that you wanted to talk about operational art. So I did what any student would do. I went back to my notes and I actually dug around. I was like, what did I say about operational art when I was, or what did I think of operational art when I was a student? And that was, to me, what informed my definition was I looked at ADP3O, I looked at JP3O, and I allowed those two to kind of inform how I saw this idea of arrangement of tactical actions, time, space, purpose, and pursuing strategic objectives, right? That suddenly I began to relook the way I thought of strategic leaders and the decisions that they made. I would also like to say that I became much more forgiving, not just because of the fact that I was now looking at these leaders from the lens of previous experiences, somebody at the tactical echelon, but also understanding that, like, hey, you're a strategic leader at a major war in which you are anchored by the experiences that you had previously. It doesn't matter whether it's somebody that is anchored back to the global war on terror, or it is somebody that is anchored back to the Franco-Prussian conflicts. You're still, those individuals are still limited by the experiences that they've had. Suddenly that gave a lot of, I was willing to be not necessarily less critical, but I accepted their humanity and the limitations of their knowledge. People like Haig, like Joffre, like Pershing, right? And Fox Connor, these amazing leaders, all of whom were still human in the decisions that they were making, straight down to the tactical level. And it makes you reconsider, yes, the war was awful. Bad decisions were made by leaders, but there was a reason that they were making them. And sometimes experience is hard. It's hard to get past that, right?
I think it's interesting that you bring that up. Do you think that's changed since you've kind of retired? You've like reframed your opinion since then? Or do you think that's...
Ooh, that's hard. I started coming to terms with the idea of you know, re-looking leaders and re-looking decision makers and decisions that they made and putting them back, giving those individuals back their humanity. I will say that actually began here in places like Sam's, where I stood back and started to look at leaders for the context that they grew up in, partly because of, you know, for instance, U.S. Grant, right? We have right up at the top of Grant Avenue is Grant's statue. First of all, as somebody who appreciates art, that's a powerful thing to have. It's a beautiful statue, very well done. But also along with it, knowing that that individual, he was flawed. He was a human. He made good decisions. He was also fired at points, right? But he made wonderful decisions. And there was moments in which, yeah, you can only work with the information that you have. Now, as far as how does a staff go, I will say seeing military history museums, it's one of those areas where I always look at collections to see on occasion how is the staff represented? How is staff work? And what in a collection speaks to me as a staff officer? What do I connect with, right? That intimate actuality, which is, it's a museum idea that I connect with the object and I place upon it all of these experiences that I've had to be able to go and see this thing, this unique piece of history, right? So when you think about that, now I look for stuff that relates and resonates to my staff experiences. How do you do that as a leader? How do you keep encouraging that? Well, I think part of it is when you go to a museum, look for things that speak to you, and also actively look for things that speak to your subordinates, to your soldiers, if you're taking them there as part of professional development.
So a quick follow-up to that. We're focusing on military museums for obvious reasons, but you did mention earlier any museum. So the challenge question then is, there's an obvious narrative that we can pull for our profession in World War I, World War II Museum, for example. What could we get out of a smaller like the Lone Jack Civil War Battle Museum, right? Or maybe an art museum. You know, like what can we do? Bring our soldiers, airmen, guardians, Marines, and help educate anybody in our service with something like that.
So I always, I understand that I'm, you know, I work with a military or with a war museum right now. But my favorite thing to do as working in education and outreach is to go to art museums, not just because I love provenance and provenance research and understanding the object biographies, the deep history and ownership and also the legal architecture behind artwork, but also because there's an opportunity to talk about very human, very real experiences behind art. Major art movements stem from significant social movements. The ability to be able to take, it doesn't matter, right? You platoon of infantrymen, take him to an art museum and be like, I get it. It's sometimes it's naked people and there is stuff that you will not understand. And somebody somewhere is going to make the comment that my kid could do this with crayons. Yeah, sure. I get it. But at the same time, the ability to first of all, guide a discussion with soldiers or guide a discussion with airmen, Marines, anybody, and say, this is, what about this piece of art? What about this thing that you are seeing resonates with you? What is the story that is told? How do you, would you want to change your phone screensaver to, or your phone wallpaper to this piece of art? Would you share it as social media? Would you develop a playlist on Spotify for it? You know, those kinds of things. When you have that experience, that first of all, people like to see themselves and their experiences in museums. It's nice. Also, along with it, like, hey, there is an ability for us to teach history from museums. I love to do this with SAM students. Going down to the Nelson Atkins specifically, we talk about framing and reframing and narrative and the importance of stories and how art movements are modernization the same way that military movements are modernization as well. Right? Everything has to build on itself.
When you talked to SAMs last time they were at the museum, you emphasized the importance of narrative visiting the museum. Can you just kind of explain what you mean by that?
So narrative, and again, this is what my understanding or my lens and my interpretation of what is narrative comes from, well, let's be honest, it comes from here, here. Actually, it comes from over at Seminar 4 in Muir Hall. It's really great. But those ideas of, you know, a storyteller, the individual that is actually, or group of individuals that are shaping those facts and that information, right? To be able to tell the story and place the experiences and that information in context, that to me has shaped what I believe is to be narrative. What that also does to a certain extent for me, looking back and as a military historian, is understand that there is a purpose behind every story that is told. There is sometimes those purposes are completely selfish, right? The idea of autobiographies written by leaders long after the fact. Sometimes they are accidental, right? The narrative changes just because you become older, wiser. You tell the story differently. The facts may shift a little bit within your own personal context. You have new information that's introduced to you. Those kinds of things will shape how a narrative is unfolding for the individual telling, the storyteller themselves. Now, how does that apply to operational art and to the idea of planners and what planners will do? It's recognize that, first of all, I would say anytime that you're acting with interagency, you're planning with allies and partners, when they think of their own story, of their own military experiences, and that is the weight of all of the military experiences that they'll have, well, geez, that's... they are coming at it with a very specific lens. There is information that will be shared. Sometimes there is stuff that we don't want to talk about. Sometimes there is an entire history. And we think about it every time we put on our uniform, you know, the AGSUs, right? There is artifacts and objects that carry the burden and the weight of military history for the United States military. That is part of our narrative, and that is part of our history. We take that with us wherever we go. That sometimes shapes a little bit our interactions. again, it comes back to humanity, I suppose, right? I accept the humanity of, and therefore I accept everybody's narrative. Now, do I plan against it? I don't know.
Yeah, I love that sentiment of just like strategic empathy, and that museums can bring that, any museum can really bring that to, you know, a group. And when you're trying to create, you know, maybe like a multinational coalition, like those narratives are so important. Museums are a great vehicle to kind of build that.
So when you think of, it's a great example, right? I love Les Invalides in Paris. It's a absolutely bearing the weight of French military history. And there is a strong, especially when it talks about the Second World War, there is a strong need to identify and to venerate, understandably so, the Free French Army and also the role that partisan fighters played within the Second World War. Now the question is, bearing that entire weight of history, how does that sometimes influence narratives and ideas and social ideas of what it means to be a partisan fighter, of what it means to be in the resistance in France? Sometimes does that overshadow or does that miss a key critical part of our history discussing capitulation or discussing, even worse sometimes, the idea of genocide, of considerable loss or destruction, permitted loss and destruction, right? Or colonization, all of that. That's hard, right? When national museums or when especially military museums, if you were to look at the United States just from its monuments that exist in Washington, D.C. alone, you'd stand back and think that we were a nation built for war. That's a pretty significant thing to say silently by the monuments and by the monuments and museums that we have, right?
Are there any special events coming up at the museum that we should be made aware of?
Ooh, yes, as a matter of fact. So first things first, if I were to, like, I'd be remiss. A couple of my friends at the museum, these are my peers. These are actually not even just my peers. Some of the individuals that work in the curatorial and collections management staff they worship the ground they walk on because they're freaking awesome. They're so cool. And it's been a treat to learn and watch them work in exhibit design. Every day I learn a lot from them. But the really cool part of this is, like I said, war museums have an ability to be able to reach a large, or they're talking about a social phenomenon. We have one that's opening shortly called The Little War. And it's the experiences of children in war, specifically framed through the lens of how did First World War affect children? And also, how did children see this war itself? The idea of reframing from a lens of young eyes. More importantly, as we decided to do, and this wasn't my decision, this was actually my peers again, who are chef's kiss, perfect. Not only did they write these labels for this exhibit or this exhibition for adults, but they did a second set of labels for children. So they're actually written with children in mind so that they will read them and understand them. This brings out things like toys, children's uniforms, drawings, all of that narrative of what it's like to be a child. And then also at the same spot, there will be little things that we can do as far as activities that can engage families as well. There is more information available about all the different events that we do, which includes things like the Pershing Lecture Series as part of public programming. We have a blood drive coming up in the month of October. All of it is at theworldwar.org/events.
One of my favorite things about the World War I Museum, and for our listeners who maybe haven't been, that are coming to Fort Leavenworth, you will probably, if you're coming to Sam's, you'll definitely go. But if you're just coming to, like, first time being stationed, like, it is definitely worth the trip. It's just a world-class museum. And I'm a mother of young children, and I find it still accessible for them, too. So I think that's really special. As you know, our last question is always sort of a scripted one. But what is one book and or podcast that you're currently reading and listening to, and why?
So first thing, because I am a grad student and I'm finishing my monograph right now with museum studies, Wayne Stanholtz's Prohibiting Plunder, which specifically is discussing changes of international norms, and it's looking at it and examining it through war looting. So I study, like I said, provenance and where provenance intersects with war itself. This was one of those times in which I came across a document that discusses international statutes of Hague, Liber, Geneva, all of it, and used looting as the case study as opposed to the other way around. That was a reframe and a relens for me that I had not considered. Also, because I'm in preservation planning and I'm looking at those kinds of things as well, the Anarchist Guide to Historic House Museums, which is a manifesto that challenges some of the conventional practices that we have for historic house museums, which are our, you know, for big museums, historic house museums, the house is also an object that we have to discuss within its relation to a community. And then I will say, because I needed to break away from grad student stuff, I also do military war things as well. So I'm working with a piece right now that is talking about machine guns and the development of machine gun technology, so that way we can have some more educational content out there. And I'm reading Little Hearts, The Real War, 1914 to 1918, and the understanding of why, you know, how does combined arms account for also direct fire weapon systems, massing direct fire weapon systems. And Withering Fire by George Rack has also been another one, along with the Field Service Regulations of 1907 for the United States Army. It's super fun. Doctrine Never Leaves Me. As far as podcasts go, oh my God, well, I'm breaking doctrine. No, no, it's not going to be breaking doctrine this time. Let's see. So I would say if you love museums, if people really love museums, the Art Fund's Meet Me at the Museum, the Imperial War Museum's Conflicts of Interest, and Side Door from the Smithsonian. And if you want something local for the Nelson Atkins in an art museum, A Frame of Mind, which talks about the idea of interpreting collections in new and novel ways. All of them get after how museums function in their different types of museums. And if you really, really, really loved, if you are getting ready for PCS season and you're thinking like, oh my God, I miss the days of Young Men in Fire. A great one to check out is Wildfire, and it's by the REI Co-op. And it is specifically talking about the idea of not just preservation of national spaces, national lands, but also the idea of understanding a phenomenon of wildfire and how that can impact certain areas of collective preservation. And that is that's my advice.
Definitely gonna have to check some of that stuff out. And Nikki, thank you so much for coming here today. And on a personal note, as growing up in Kansas City, Missouri, born and raised, and seeing what the Liberty Memorial was to what it is today, thank you for what you do at the World War I Museum, because that is an incredible place. I've taken my kids there. I love going there. My entire family visits on the regular. So thank you for what you do. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Actually, my boss loved it, or my boss, my our director at the museum, Dr. Matt Naylor, he always says that it is Kansas City's front lawn, which for a minute I had to stop and be like, oh, that's a bit, that's, you know, kind of over the top. And then I stood and looked at it and I'm, no, he's absolutely right. It really is.
Well, thank you for stopping by, and we hope to have you on again sometime.
Oh, thank you.
The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by checking us out on Twitter at US_SAMS, Instagram at US.SAMS, and on LinkedIn. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or wish to engage with us, please email us at operationalarch@gmail.com.